Welcome to Original Lines, where we talk with original people with original ideas living the creative life. I'm your host, Laura Allen, and today we're talking with visual artist Tara Tamarabucci. Hi, Tara, and welcome.
Oh, hi.
Tara is a West Coast native, living and working now in Seattle. She's got double degrees in journalism and fine art, painting, and her work has been exhibited widely in Portland, Seattle, and elsewhere. She recently created a public installation for Seattle Sculpture Walk. She's also a curator, an arts program manager, a dancer, and a mom.
And that sounds like a lot.
It does sound like a lot. That's what I was thinking. I was like, wow, I think I missed a few things in there, too. I was looking at all your website and everything. I'm like, oh, my gosh, she's busy. So when did you first know that you wanted to live a life in the arts?
When I was a little kid, we had an elementary school art teacher who would visit us once a month in our classroom. I think that she worked at a few different schools in Irvine, California. Mm-hmm. And it seemed like art was the one area that I excelled at. And it wasn't like apparent to me, but every year she would always take what I did and hang it somewhere. So there'd be like this art festival in Laguna Beach, that she'd always hang it there, or there'd be a show of children's work from, you know, Orange County, and it'd be like at the art college, or maybe it'd be in a shopping mall. Mm-hmm. So, and she would tell me, oh, you should become an artist when you grow up. And I would tell my parents this, and my mom, I mean, she kind of played the devil's advocate, mm-hmm. and would say, oh, well, maybe you should think about being an architect or mm-hmm. something right. where you can make a living. And I didn't really know any artists who had like a successful practice. I have an uncle who has a master's degree in painting, but he really struggled as an artist, and he put more of his focus on shiatsu practice in the end. Mm-hmm. And then I have my god sister's father was a painter, but he worked as a mailman. I just didn't really know anyone who was mm-hmm. like showing. And I think growing up in Orange County, it's not the most creative community. So uh-huh. there wasn't a lot. Maybe we just weren't in the right circles, but a right. lot of kids are trying to become doctors or lawyers or something like that. So I took drafting in high school. Then after a while, I was interested in politics. Mm-hmm. So I went to school in Washington, D.C., and then I ended up being a journalism major. Uh-huh. And so I don't know. It was sort of like one of those things that you deny yourself.
Right.
And even growing up, I was a pianist, and I used to compete in piano, but I had known at an early age that I didn't want to be a pianist, professional, because when I was like 8 or 9 years old, my piano teacher dropped a lot of students. Mm-hmm. She wanted to start a recording career, uh-huh. but then she went bankrupt.
Oh.
And then during my lesson, these repo men came in, oh. and I was like in the third or fourth grade, just like doing my playing the piano, and these men were like taking out her furniture
oh my gosh.
And things, and that really stuck in my mind.
Yeah, I guess like this is the life of a professional pianist.
Yes, yeah, the life of the artist.
Oh,
so
my gosh.
I don't know. And then when I was in college, I had friends who would major in fine art uh-huh. and or even like museum studies or art history. Mm-hmm. And DC is a good town for studying museums and art history. But I don't know. There was just something in my head where I just kind of blocked out the idea that it would be possible for me.
Yeah.
And but I was always envious of mm-hmm. of those people. Yeah.
Yeah.
It wasn't until after I did try journalism and public relations that I realized that that wasn't right for me, and it took a lot of soul searching. And then I thought, oh, maybe I'll try studying architecture. Like, mm-hmm. these are like real baby steps for
right,
me.
Right, right.
And I was living in Portland, Oregon, And I started taking a couple prerequisite classes at Portland State just to give it a try. And I took art history and drawing. And then I realized somewhere in there, like, I should just study art.
Right.
So I went to PNCA, Pacific Northwest College of Art. And then that's how it started.
Great. Well,
yes.
Well, yeah. Good. So your first show, solo show, you kind of started your career in Portland, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Where was your first solo show? Do you remember?
I would say when I lived in Portland, I struggled a lot with, I think because I graduated when I was 30.
Mm-hmm.
And so my biological clock was ticking. I had been married already for like several years. And I had trouble balancing work and making art. And I don't think I was like in a really good creative space. So when I think of that time, I hardly think of that I was really showing or creating that much. But I think maybe my first just me was at Milepost 5, which is, they have residences and studios.
Mm-hmm.
It used to be, I want to say it was like a, maybe it was a place where people who were mentally ill lived, mm-hmm. or something like that. And then it closed, and then they switched it over to art studios, mm-hmm. and condos for artists.
Cool. So what's it like putting a show for you to put a show together? Do you have a central theme first, or do you have the work first and then the show comes, or how does that?
Oh.
Do you know?
Or? I don't, well, it's funny because the last couple of years I've been trying to get more into public art.
Uh-huh.
And so I have this show coming up this week, but I feel really rusty at the idea of hanging a show of my work.
Uh-huh.
And it also involves me doing all the things, like ordering the postcards and making the signs and ordering the letters and everything.
Right.
Whereas in the last year, I've done more things through the city or other organizations. And so all I've had to do is bring the work to be installed, or I've just installed the work and then they had the material, the other materials. So I feel like it's a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah. Several months ago, I was invited to join CORE.
Mm-hmm.
And I had these sort of some installation ideas in mind. But I already had all these pieces that I hung in for storefronts.
Uh-huh.
So I was like, okay, well, I already have 30 of these pieces. And then I had some ideas for these paintings came up. So I thought, oh, maybe I'll just work on doing some studio work,
uh-huh.
and work on trying to do some of these things and see if I can get them resolved,
right.
and see what happens. So it's sort of not exactly planned out. Or maybe it is, but it just sort of happened.
Good. Well, for our listeners who don't know, CORE Gallery is one of the best co-op galleries in Seattle. It's in Pioneer Square, right?
Yes.
Right on, I can't remember which street is it on.
Prefontaine.
Prefontaine. Okay, it's a super gallery. And Shumpike is a nonprofit organization, a storefront. Tara mentioned storefronts. Shumpike goes in and negotiates with empty storefronts and has artists come in and commissions them to fill the storefronts with either installation work or a show or what have you. And it's a really super, super program. And so I'm glad that you were a part of it. And was the show at storefronts, was it the perler bead pieces?
Yes.
She brought a couple of pieces here today to the studio. And they're awesome. It's kind of a mix of like fine craft and art. I'm very interested right now in the line between. I want to talk to you about that, about like fine craft and art. Like with me, it's sort of the textiles and the basketry. It's like, oh my gosh, people are doing amazing things with what you might have thought were materials that you would craft with, but then they're making these beautiful fine art pieces with it.
For these, it kind of came about just from being with my daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was pregnant and then I had a baby, I really wasn't sure if I was ever going to get back into art again.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had this realization at some point that having her and being around her was actually helping me get back into the arts.
Ah.
Yeah. And it really opened my eyes to other mediums.
Mm-hmm.
So with the perler beads, I learned about them through my daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And to make them, you need parental supervision and help because it involves using a clothing iron to finally set the beads together. So I just Well, she was making like a puppy or something or a heart. And then I thought, well, I would like to give it a try. And then my natural inclination was to make an abstraction with them. Mm-hmm. And then I thought, oh, this is something. And so I started making them because it felt like some sort of art practice.
Right.
Yeah.
In artists, I've always admired like Robert Rauschenberg and Louise Nevelson, who use like ordinary materials, because that is the place where the sophistication of design and fine art actually shows the most. Because you've used these completely like ordinary materials that are plastic perler beads, but these are beautiful. Beautifully designed. They're gorgeous little works. And so, did you get somebody to fabricate the plexiglass
yes.
cases for them? And do you have to do a lot of that? Like when you're doing public art, like work with more than one person, like it's not all you, right? It's a team effort.
This is the one thing I've had fabricated so far. I first tried to make the boxes myself, mm-hmm. and then it would take me a really long time, and I would also have to make multiple boxes until I got to a box that looked okay.
So it's more of a waste of material and stuff. Yeah.
Yes, it turned out that it was would cost the same, and that the professional acrylic person would do a good job, much better job. And it turns out that, well, I was looking at the Tap Plastics website, and they have all these really fun YouTube videos about how to work with acrylic, mm-hmm. and they make it look really easy. So I ordered these pieces that I could put together into a box with the measurements, but it turns out that that's not the way to make a really nice looking box. You need a router. So he was explaining to me that you cut the pieces larger than you wanted, and then you end up routing it off.
Together. Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
And then there's a kind of glue that melts the material and kind of welds it together.
Oh.
And then he had a special, I mean, I just have like a propane torch that you get mm-hmm. at the hardware store, but he must know the exact temperature, and he had this like huge tank, and
it's like framing, right? I mean, there's,
yes.
you can spend, I mean, the framer people, you kind of take it for granted that these things like the frames and the containers is like something, oh, I can learn to do that. It's not, it's an art form that these people have spent all their lives, just like a fine artist has spent all their lives learning to paint like they do. Framers particularly are extremely good at what they do. And so, you know, pay for the professional to do it. You do your professional work and then get the other professional to do it. But yeah, so anyway, back to your daughter. That was really interesting. You say that you work, because I mean, you sound like you have so many things going on. She must be integrated with your art life. I mean, does she help you? I mean, do you just work with her there? I mean, how do you work that out?
Oh, no, not so much. Mm-hmm. I mean, I like to think of, I would love that. But she's really busy. She's at school, and then I work in the studio, but I just get a lot of inspiration from her. Mm-hmm. I like the idea of trying not to separate the artist's life from the parenting life, uh-huh. or not denying that I'm a parent. When you look at women in art historically, a lot of them haven't been able to even be parents
Right.
Or it's just something that people will have denied themselves in the past. Uh-huh. And so I can't like take her out to lots of openings because it's late at night, but sometimes I will, or she'll go to things with me. And then I'll just try to, sometimes it just comes up where something from our life together will make me want to try to take that thing and then put it in my art practice.
Interesting. Do you encourage her in the arts? I know you took her to ballet this morning.
Oh, yes.
Is she into the arts?
Yeah, she, doesn't really have a lot of visual arts at her school. Mm-hmm. In Seattle, each school either has a full-time visual art teacher or a full-time music teacher.
Oh, okay.
And so at her school, they happen to have a full-time music teacher. So she doesn't really get that much foundation. And I need to take the time to sit down and do lessons with her. But I do coordinate a program at her school where we have an art teacher come in. Mm. It's not for that much time, but it's something. But with performing arts though, she seems like she's more of a performer, mm-hmm. and it's not something that was really on my radar. I dance. Mm-hmm. So I go to ballet class, in modern, and I would take her to dance, professional dance and theaters.
Right.
And, I'm like a dance fan. And so that was always something that she was always enrolled in. But then this last summer, she took a camp at the Wing Luke Museum, mm-hmm. a storyteller camp. And the teachers told me that I should enroll her in acting.
Oh.
So I thought, oh, okay. And I started thinking maybe my kid really, you know, she really likes listening to musical theaters, mm-hmm. even though she hasn't seen any of these plays. She wants to hear the songs. And I was thinking, oh, I guess I just need to kind of encourage this triple threat.
Yeah.
When I wasn't the kind of parent where she was born and I thought, oh, let's get into showbiz.
Right.
But now I'm like, okay, I signed her up for jazz and then she's in acting and then ballet and then she joined the choir at school. So
I think show tunes are your future. You have show tunes in your future. So yeah. I think that's a pretty good place to take a break. So,
okay.
Yeah, we'll be right back.
Hey there. Did you know that you can find Original Lines on both iTunes and Stitcher? So whether you have an iPhone or Android, you can always catch the latest episode. Be sure to subscribe to us, and we love reviews. Thanks.
Okay, and hi, we're back with Tara Tamarabuchi. And Tara, we were talking a little bit earlier about, it was the Camouflage Net Project, right?
Yes.
Yeah, my husband and I saw that, and it was very... It's this net, almost like it's like an army net that they would use to cover like jeeps or, you know, to hide them or tanks or whatever. But instead of being woven, having like camouflage material or like camo color material, Tara had woven it with, like really bright kimono fabrics. And so can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Oh, yes. Well, I had got the idea. Last year was the 75th anniversary of Executive Order 9066, which sent Japanese Americans and Japanese nationals living in the United States on the West Coast to internment camps during World War II. Mm-hmm. Dorothea Lange and Ansel Adams were two photographers hired by the War Relocation Authority or administration who were allowed to go into the camps and take photos. And Dorothea, she seemed to take more photos of people doing their daily lives. Mm-hmm. And Ansel Adams, some of it was more portraiture. And I had seen his photos and they seemed kind of more happy. Mm-hmm. And hers were, it seemed like it was a more journalistic. And some of the photos she took was at this camouflage net factory in Manzanar camp. Mm-hmm. And so people at three different locations, Gila River, Manzanar, and Santa Anita Racetrack, that was a job that you could have, making these camouflage nets.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they made tens of thousands of nets for the Army.
Wow.
When I had thought about people working in camps, I always thought of like farm labor. A lot of people were taken out of camps to work in the surrounding farms. And I didn't really consider that people were doing some sort of handiwork. Uh-huh. And so that was intriguing to me. And I wanted to also make a camouflage net, and I thought about it. And I used to do Japanese traditional dance. Uh-huh. So I sometimes like to wear a kimono, and I'm interested in the patterns and the fabric and the different kinds of crafts for making different kinds of kimonos. Uh-huh. And so I thought, oh, I should use kimono fabric and weave that into the net. And that could be a way to send pride of heritage, uh-huh. Sort of an intention to send back.
Right.
Because my family, they were very ashamed of being incarcerated.
Yeah.
And it wasn't something that they liked to talk about. And then the third piece was that the idea of camouflage as being this visual filter. Mm-hmm. With the change in presidential administration, back when I planned the net, there was a lot of issues happening with... there was the Muslim ban.
Right.
And then talking about building a wall. And so I was thinking that if you have a whole diversity of people walking through this net, then you could see them as all interconnected with each other.
Right, right.
So there was that. And then after it was installed, it ended up looking like a camp barrack.
Uh-huh.
That had the shape of the camp barrack. So that part was surprising in the end.
Yeah.
To me.
Yeah. Well, I loved it. It also, all of those things, and also, I think it almost had a feeling of like reclaiming, with something that's beautiful and has a rich heritage. It's almost like you reclaiming this artifact of war. You know what I'm saying? That's this artifact of this horrible time, but then it's also mixed with this beauty. It was a really touching piece, but I'm glad I got to see it. For our listeners, what is public art? I mean, I know you took the public art boot camp, right? I saw it on your CV. And I've got several friends, you know, here that have taken it. And so what is it? What is public art? What does that mean?
Oh, let's see. There's a whole variety of public art. Mm-hmm. One is art that's out in public areas. And just anyone can walk by it and experience it. Mm-hmm. I think that's the general idea.
Uh-huh.
When I went to the boot camp, they had a whole list of different kinds of public art. But yeah, that's probably the general idea.
Yeah, because I think most people, what you think of first is, you know, some big sculpture somewhere. You know, because that's the main thing of public art that we have is a large scale sculpture in the middle of a square or whatever. But it's more than that.
Yeah, it could be performance also.
Yeah.
And there's temporary public art. That's what I've done so far. And then there's the permanent ones, mm-hmm. which... Permanent public art is art that can last for 30 years.
That's when you get the big bronzes and marble, big giant steels, Richard Serra and all that stuff.
So yes.
Is it different when you like conceive a public art project? Do you have a different, is there a different feel than when you're like doing studio work?
Oh, yes. I like it a lot because you can engage with everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas with the gallery, to me, it's not as fulfilling because it's just the only people who experience it are the people who go to galleries.
Uh-huh.
And then also as a mom, I feel like, I don't know, families, they don't really get to experience as much art in that way. So I really like public art that anyone,
uh-huh.
people who aren't even seeking it out, they'll just come upon it. And then it also... helps make areas nicer too, mm-hmm. and feel safer. But then also as working on something, when you're making work for a gallery, you don't know if you're going to get paid for the work.
Right.
But with the public art, it's upfront. You know how much mm-hmm. you're going to get paid. You submit a budget and you can pay yourself. So that's really nice.
Yeah. And like you say, it turns a space into, it's an investment in a community because it turns a space, whether it's temporary or permanent, it seems to me like it turns a space into something that even the city is saying, hey, this is a worthwhile space. This is a vibrant space and we care about it and we care enough to beautify it. We care enough to activate it, to make it, to engage with it. Do you have any other projects underway? Any other public things, ideas, or anything working?
Oh, well, I...
Or are you just trying to get through the show?
I applied for the SpaceWorks project in Tacoma mm-hmm. to do a storefront. I haven't heard back from them on what the next part of the... I mean, I got in.
Uh-huh.
I haven't heard back for what the next part of the process is. But I have plans for an installation.
Good.
Yeah. I'm half Japanese and half Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of what I do has been looking at Japanese visual language or patterns and motifs.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't done that much with my Chinese identity.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've been planning this project that's around these ancient Tang Dynasty burial objects.
Uh-huh.
And so back at during that time, the fancy ruling class people, when they would die, they would be mummified and set in a a jade burial suit. Mm-hmm. And it's, they have like these rectangular jade flat beads that are wired together all around the body. Uh-huh. And I, as a mom, I've been thinking about how much I've changed over how we go through these different developmental stages in my life. And I found this diary from when I was in my early 20s and late teens, and it was it was just awful. I did not recognize this person. Uh-huh. And then I've been back to Washington, D.C., where I went to college, and it's this town that kind of reminds me of when I was that age. And it's also the kind of city where people aren't really settling down so much. Mm-hmm. Very career oriented. A lot of college age people, a lot of people in their 20s who are working in politics or policy. I don't know. There's not a lot of children around. Mm-hmm. And it's not a very child friendly city. So, yeah, I went there last year and I thought, gosh, this is such a strange place. Yeah. And I had identified so strongly with that city when I was young. So I was thinking about making a burial suit to my younger self.
Interesting.
And I was a DJ a long time ago in the 90s.
There's another thing.
I played drum and bass. Uh-huh. And I was like, in the 90s, I was a raver. Mm-hmm. And a club kid in Washington, D.C. And I would wear those fat pants.
Nice.
I had this whole, I don't know, some sort of vintage style with lots of like jewelry, acrylic jewelry or rhinestones. It'd either be like a rhinestone day or acrylic day or something. It was weird. It was funny. It was a way to rebel against Washington, D.C., because in college, everybody has an internship and you need to have a couple suits to wear.
Right.
So this burial suits would be made with mirrors.
Oh.
Yeah, I did order lots of these mirrors that have holes in them so I can wire them together.
Oh, that's going to be interesting.
Yeah, so that's one part of it. And then another part is the objects. So back then in China, they would make objects that would help you into your next life. Mm-hmm. So they would make houses out of ceramics, and they would have like little cows and sheep and pigs. Mm-hmm. And so I've been trying to think of ways what that means today for me. And I've been working a lot with resin in my paintings, and I've been thinking about, I did order this resin mold from China where you make several pieces that come together to make a little house. Mm-hmm. It's sort of this idea of a consumer society or countries like China, you know, they can just make so many things for us to order, and there's just too much supply.
Yeah, yeah.
And also being Chinese American, it's something that concerns me about this country. I mean, when I was growing up, there was the concern about communism and what did Mao do?
Right.
And then now we have this whole other economic thing where it also, other countries are doing the same thing. And
right.
So I was thinking about making multiples of resin houses that were kind of glittering.
Interesting. It sounds like you're still exploring, like you're exploring, you're going to explore this as you go. That does sound, that sounds awesome. So, okay, so you were a DJ and you also do dance. You're talking about the vision, you know, like, oh, my daughter is performing art, but you're also a dancer. So it sounds like she's got a little of it, honestly, you know, but, so what do you do? Do you still dance? Do you do some dance?
I haven't been dancing so much lately because I've been working on this show. Uh-huh. And then my daughter is at Cornish Prep Dance, and they do a big Nutcracker every year at Cornish Playhouse, and I was in charge of the props. Mm-hmm. So I was busy making some props and fixing them. Yeah, I want to get back into it right after I install the show.
Yeah. So how do you think that your art, is there a common thread between your visual art and your dance? Is this just are they both just forms of expression? Do you use?
Yeah, I have tried to figure out ways to incorporate them. I think in my paintings, I did start getting interested in using Japanese patterns through Japanese dance because mm-hmm. I was wearing kimonos, and I was learning about what each kimono meant because they might have certain motifs that you wear at certain times of the year, or mm-hmm. maybe it's a celebratory dance, so they have celebratory motifs and patterns on them. So maybe that's one way, but I haven't really, been able to do something that performative myself.
Mm-hmm.
I am collaborating right now with a choreographer named Noelle Chun. And I'm supposed to help her make some props. So that's as much as I've done. I guess I'm used to being directed more as a dancer.
Mm-hmm.
And I have performed for her in the past here in Seattle. But yeah, I don't know. Maybe someday I'll be able to figure that one out.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess dance is a hobby for me, and it's a way to exercise without feeling like I'm exercising.
Right.
I'm just trying to keep up my technical abilities and mm-hmm. in practice.
Yeah. Okay. Well, tell us I think we're about done. Tell us where we can find out more about your work.
Oh, okay. My website is www. Okay. Well, my name is really long. But it's taratamaribuchi.com. That's spelled taratamaribuchi.com.
Okay.
And then I have a show at Core Gallery that opens on Wednesday, January 31st.
Oh, okay. Well, good. I will also put links in the podcast show notes. So if you want to find out more, you can do that. And thank you very much for being here.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Yeah, this has been awesome. So, all right. Well, this has been Laura Allen for Original Lines. It's a production of Two Ponies Press. And you can find out more about us at www.twoponiespress.com or look for us on any of the major podcasting services, iTunes, Stitcher, what have you. Thanks for being here, and see you next time.